Dear Tightrope family, we are joining Patreon. We're partnering with Patreon because they are empowering creators to maintain independence.
To preserve our independence of mind, to preserve our free spirits, and most importantly, to preserve our quest for truth.
By joining, you will gain access to special opportunities to engage with us as we share what we're reading, offer behind-the-scenes clips from our episodes, and ask you for your input around what we should focus on next.
Please be with us on this journey.
Together, we can amplify truth, cultivate hope, and work to create a just world. Thank you, and stay strong.
There was a pandemic response program. There were simulations carried out of what to happen if a pandemic comes, some of them as late as last October. There were American scientists working with Chinese colleagues on the very dangerous but crucial efforts to identify new coronaviruses in the caves in southern China, where they're mostly found.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum the colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility? Well, we're really delighted. We have an extraordinary guest with us on the tightrope today. We have Professor Noam Chomsky, who is an extraordinary thinker and scholar, and we want to really welcome you to the tightrope, Professor Chomsky, and we'll try to jump right in and have a conversation. But welcome, welcome, welcome to the tightrope.
Thank you very much.
Before we dive into the deep end, I just wanted to ask, a lot of people out here care for you and think of you as a very important sort of figure, spiritual leader in a way. And we're wondering how you're doing with this pandemic. So can you give us a sense of how you're doing and how you're feeling? And is everything okay?
It's pretty simple. Staying at home, not seeing anybody. Fortunately, we're in Arizona where land is given away. It's very cheap. So we bought a small house out of town, has a lot of desert behind, no people, a lot of rattlesnakes, but they don't carry COVID. So we can walk around, let the dogs run a little. We're not totally cooped up, but I'm busier than I've ever been in my life. It turns out everybody in the world wants an interview, a talk, a statement. So I'm on this device constantly, not with great efficiency, as you saw, but somehow managing. But it's not a big problem for us.
Right. Well, I'm glad. I'm sure many people will be very happy to hear that.
No, but I think one of the reasons why they're coming after you tooth and nail is that you are an international treasure, bona fide, unadulterated intellectual genius, reforming linguistic, cognitive science. In his 20s, the syntactic structures comes out and the impact is overwhelming. Freedom fighter par excellence, be it occupation, domination, exploitation, no matter what it is, there's an unbelievable prophetic impulse shot through the scientific analysis of empire, of capitalism, of authoritarian forms of socialism and so forth. And then there's just a wonderful Noam. I mean, just an exemplary truth teller, always on call, always ready to lend his time, his energy. And then look at him now, 91 years young, all the way from Fairhill Street, East Oak Lane, northern section of Philadelphia, strong as ever. It's a beautiful thing, brother.
Yeah, good old Northeast Philadelphia.
It's still so humble. Let's look at this present situation, though. This unprecedented moment of multi-layered catastrophes, the possibility of the planet going under, be it nuclear or ecological, the wealth inequality, the escalating neo-fascisms, the xenophobic resurgences all around the world. How, as an intellectual, does one sustain the vocation that you talked about way back in 1967, that February 23rd piece, The Responsibility of Intellectuals, delivered at the Hillel Society at Harvard initially, in Mosaic Journal, and then in the New York Review of Books? How do you sustain that? And what do you make of where most of the intelligentsia actually resides and habits and writes these days?
Easy to sustain. There's basically three reasons. The one reason is just looking at history. If you look at history, it been through very hard times. A lot has been accomplished in many ways. It's a much better country, much better world than it was 50 years ago, 100 years ago. Not in all respects, but in many respects. The many battles that were fought hard and won, we can just take for granted and move on. That's one reason. Another reason is just seeing the remarkable, impressive dedication and activism of lots of people. So take just what happened after the murder of George Floyd. Very quickly, the most substantial social movement in American history developed spontaneously with enormous public support. Lots of solidarity, working hard to change things that are important with courage, enthusiasm. That's another reason. There's a third reason. You basically don't have any choice. You can either say, everything's hopeless, I give up, help ensure that the worst will happen, or you can grasp the opportunities that exist, and they do exist, and maybe you can make it a better world. It's not much of a choice. Those three very easy reasons to sustain commitment to the extent that you can.
So many of our fellow intellectuals decide to be conformist and complacent or downright cowardly. There's something else going on that has been able to sustain you going in the opposite direction.
People make their choices. We can make ours. These are the ones we ought to make. There's good reasons for them. You make them. Treasure makes them. I try to make them. The more that do, the better we chance we have for decent survival. Mm. And we should recognize that the issues today are literally survival. It's kind of remarkable to look at the massive coverage of the two conventions and see that the most crucial issues that have arisen in all of human history are not mentioned. I try to find a word. I mean, the critical difference between the parties, whatever you think about them, there actually is a chasm on two crucial, essential issues, issues of survival. Are we going to be able to address the growing environmental catastrophe in time, or are we not? That's a question that has to be answered within a decade or two. And whatever you think of the Democrats, Trump is alone in the world in pressing the accelerator to race to disaster. If this malignancy is not removed, we may not survive another 4 years of this. We may get to even irreversible tipping points. If not, it'll certainly be much harder to deal with the problems that remain in the brief period ahead. No, virtually no mention. The other issue, which is equally existential, is the threat of terminal nuclear war. It's higher now than it has been even during the Cold War, and increasing. I mean, to the extent that the doomsday clock last January, the analysts dropped minutes, moved to seconds. And since then, Trump has made it worse, dismantling the last remnants of the arms control regime, which set some constraints on the threat of total destruction, and moving to develop new, more threatening weapons in violation of past treaties, which essentially entices others to do the same. That means limiting the prospect of survival, the darkening the shadow that we've been living under for 75 years. No mention. Lots of talk about other things, but not the two questions that human beings now face for the first time in human history. The questions whether the human experiment will continue in the short term. We're not talking about millennia or centuries. We're talking about decades, and nobody's talking about it. It's a shocking comment on the whole social order. There's many other problems, urgent, significant ones. If these aren't solved, everything else is moot.
I wonder if there's a relationship between that silence and the kind of stoking of fear that is so much a part of the public political consciousness. In other words, is there a possibility that they know, or we know, right, that this is moving toward the end? And so rather than deal with that, we sort of end up in a state of constant, you know, fear mongering and hate production and a kind of a terror of the end of the world as we know it, but brought very small. Right, the end of a social world as we know it in our neighborhood, in our town, in our community, rather than an end of the world as we know it in a big sense.
Well, fortunately, there are people who are working hard on it, not ignoring it. Take the environmental crisis, take Sunrise Movement, group of young people actively working to try to bring this issue to the core of public attention and activism. As you know, they sat in on congressional offices. They received some support from the young representatives who came in on the Sanders wave, especially Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, gained the support of a Democratic senator, senior senator Ed Markey, who's been interested in the environment. They managed to put the question of a New Deal on the legislative agenda. Shortly before, lots of ridicule, dismissal, who cares about that? It's only essential for human survival. Only that. And it is. Some form of Green New Deal is essential for human survival. There are forms that are quite feasible, that fall well within our capacities. And unless we implement them within the next few years, we can say goodbye to each other. Okay? So these young people succeeded in doing it. That's exciting. Then they have been working with the climate strike last year. Huge effort of young people to try to awaken the world, the Extinction Rebellion, others. The activism that's continued and compelled the Democratic National Committee, which doesn't want any of this, but compelled them to at least include in the program policies which are not enough, but which could make a significant dent and are miles away from the destructive policies of the incumbent in power. Will they implement those policies? Well, it's a battle inside the Democratic Party. The DNC is basically Clintonite, moderate Republicans call themselves Democrats, donor-oriented. Then there's the progressive base, which is struggling to do something about the existential crises we face. And we see the battle constantly. So, for example, the activists managed to pressure both Biden and Harris to accept the idea of ending subsidies to fossil fuel industries, to stop funding the industries that are working to destroy us. They agreed to that. The DNC got wind of it, cut it out of the program. Good deal remains. That's the battle internal to the Democratic Party. Meanwhile, the Republicans are racing to disaster. The world is looking at this aghast. They can't hardly believe what's happening here. But it's happening, and we have to deal with it. Now we can. We can follow the lead of people like the Sunrise Movement, the young activists who carried out the climate strike, and those who are working hard now to try to implement these programs to force the Democratic Party to accept at least what it has on paper, not to back off in case they win the election, which is no sure thing, but in case they win the election, not to back off and say we have to go back to worrying about the deficit, which is totally crazy at this time. And then in order to pressure them, it's going to be necessary to continue the constant activism. And the fact that the leadership is being led to young people is so unspeakable, it's hard to find words for it. They're not the ones who should be taking the lead. It's the adult community who should be doing it. But in the absence of a committed adult community, they are doing it, calling us to action. And we have the chance to follow that we can do it. And the same on the other issues.
This issue of wrestling with despair on the one hand and on the other hand, knowing something must be done and we've got to be the ones to do it. When I think of intellectuals who are making a difference in a lot of ways, but seem to be much more what I see in your work over these last 70 years or so. I'm thinking of people like my dear brother Chris Hedges or brother Paul Street or even my dear brother Jumu Baraka, who's such a major force, and he's probably less in despair than the others. How do you look unflinchingly at all of the suffering and misery in the world, past and present, and still allow yourself to work through any kind of despair to be the kind of truth teller and justice seeker that you are?
You can't succumb to it. I mean, yes, there are things that are going on that are just beyond horrible. We can see it in our own cities. Take things that are happening right before our eyes. So when the Trump administration decides that now all the significant officials, relevant officials, come from the destructive industries and are given free rein. So when they decide, as they did recently, to eliminate regulations on polluting industries, fossil fuel industries, polluting industries, to eliminate regulations, two effects. One effect is to escalate the race to oblivion. But there's a local effect. Who lives near those polluting industries? Not me. I live out in the outskirts of a town. I can afford not to live next to the polluting industries. Other people can't, mostly Black, Puerto Rican, Hispanic. They can't live anywhere else. So this decision is saying, I want to kill you. That's what it says. I don't care about you. I'll increase the pollution that's killing you, and doing it in the midst of a respiratory pandemic in which pollution radically increases the already sharply disparate effect, race, class effect of the pandemic. So right in the middle of this, I'll make it worse for you. Nobody comments on it. I mean, take, say, Trump's, he's carrying out a desperate effort to try to cover up the vicious crimes he's committed against the American people. 175,000 people have died, mostly needlessly. Take a look at other countries. It's not happening. It's happening here because of the malevolence in the White House. Well, you can't come forward and say, sorry for killing all of you. So what we have to do is find a way to blame someone else. Pure cowardice and disgusting dishonesty, but it has effect. So when you decide to blame the World Health Organization and say, okay, let's destroy it, what happens? Things happen. Countless people in Africa and in Yemen and in other poor places rely on World Health Organization services simply to survive terrible diseases. That's even before the pandemic. So let's take away that security and let them die. We'll kill them, because that way maybe I can cover up my crimes and maybe it'll improve my electability. I mean, it's the kind of savagery that you can't find words for. And it's happening all over, and we act as if it's not happening.
I'm wondering what you think about the role of the complicit members of his own party around this. Before Trump actually won, there was so much, you know, critique of all the characteristics you're describing, the greed, the lying, the brash hostility and hatred. But everyone pretty much went quiet and got in line. How do we explain that level of shift? These are people who had profound critiques and now have nothing to say. He's just sort of steamrolled over everybody.
Understandable that when people are in immediate trouble, they tend to overlook other things. But it's the job of everyone who is trying to keep and who is concerned with the fate of the species and with the suffering of people in the world. It's their job to keep your eyes, keep ensure that everyone's eyes are kept on the longer term perils that we are facing. So we will emerge from this pandemic at a terrible cost and a needless cost. All you have to do is look at other countries to see that it's a needless cost. China provided all the relevant evidence on January 10th to sequence the virus. The genome gave the information to the world. The countries that cared about their citizens acted at once. They now have it pretty much under control. East Asia, South Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, New Zealand, Australia, a little later, Europe delayed, finally joined. Many of them have it reasonably under control. So Germany probably has about maybe 1/50th or so the death rate that we have, rich country similar to us. The United States is the global laggard because of the malignancy in the White House, right there. It's not obscure. And it goes back before the pandemic started. It's worth remembering what happened before. One thing is, can't blame on Trump. Goes back to the whole neoliberal assault on the society. Government is the problem, not the solution. So therefore, when the warnings came in 2003 after SARS that we're likely to face a new pandemic, the government, which has wonderful laboratories, immense resources, couldn't step in to take the actions that could be taken. Now that's neoliberalism. That's on top of the fact that the drug companies couldn't move in because they're blocked by capitalist logic. You don't spend your money on things that don't make profit tomorrow. You don't spend your money trying to work on a vaccine that maybe will be useful in 10 years and we won't make that much money from it anyway. So capitalist logic says that the hugely profitable drug companies with great labs and resources are blocked out. Neoliberalism, the plague we've been living under since Reagan and Thatcher, says the government can't step in. Okay, nobody could pick up the ball. There were things you could do, and it's worth remembering that some of them were done. So when President Obama came into office, In his first days in office, he called a meeting of the Presidential Scientific Advisory Council that had been set up by the first President Bush, and he requested that they work on a pandemic response program. Came back with it a couple of weeks later. It was put into place. There was a pandemic response program. There were simulations carried out of what to happen if a pandemic comes, some of them as late as last October. There were American scientists that were working with Chinese colleagues on the very dangerous but crucial efforts to identify new coronaviruses in the caves in southern China, where they're mostly found. That was working until January 2017. When Donald Trump came into office with his Republican sycophants. What did he do in the first days of his office? Dismantle the pandemic program, the pandemic response program. Started canceling the programs with American scientists working with Chinese colleagues, so we shouldn't know what's coming. In fact, he's continued that up until the last few weeks, in fact, canceling programs. Defunding the Center for Disease Control. First act, defund the Center for Disease Control and other health-related parts of the government. He's tried to do that every single year in office. Astonishingly, even last February, pandemic raging, budget comes from the White House. Further defunding of the Center for Disease Control, other health-related parts of government. That doesn't fit the agenda of serving the ultra-wealthy and the corporate sector. The one significant commitment of the president of the party, other than maintaining his own power, that's who they serve. So let's fund anything that could protect the population. A couple of weeks ago, fire the chief scientist in charge of vaccine development. Why? Because he raised some questions about the quack medicines that Trump is advertising. I mean, what's happening before our eyes is as if some malicious devil took over the country. And it's not far from true, in fact. That's what we're facing for the election, whether to allow this to go on for 4 years or to put a stop to it. It's not that the alternative is great. It's not. We should understand, I think, that we're not voting for Biden. We're voting against Trump. Now we're going to challenge Biden if he wins and ensure that the donor-oriented sectors of the party will not cut off programs that have to be carried out and that young people like Sunrise Movement are pressing for all the time in the forefront with us following behind. We have to make sure to do that. That's a major task for the immediate future. Can't be delayed. Very important to understand that the means to solve these problems are within our hands. There are very good, careful studies by fine analysts. Bob Pollan, co-author of mine, Jeff Sachs, have worked out detailed programs which demonstrate how we can deal with the problem, not only at benefit to the society, better world, more jobs, less destruction, better lives, at a fraction of the expenses that were used to win the Second World War. It's not utopia. We know how to do it. It's not going to happen by itself. It's not going to happen if the malignancy in the White House stays on, racing in the opposite direction. It will not happen if the DNC, the Clinton Democrats, manage to cut off all significant programs. But it can happen. We've seen the effects and the remarkable successes of the Sanders movement and the tremendous social movement that's in the streets right now, led by Black Lives Matter, and the courage and achievements of Sunrise Movement, mutual support groups arising all over the world, the Progressive International having its first international meeting in a couple of weeks, bringing together Sanders Movement in the United States, TM25, a comparable movement in Europe, lots of voices in the global south, a meeting in Iceland in a couple of weeks. Iceland, because the prime minister is part of the movement, to try to develop a counter to the reactionary international that's being constructed in the White House and is aiming, they wouldn't put it in these words, but is acting in ways which will destroy the prospects for organizing in society in order to enrich and empower themselves. Okay? That's the conflict that's developing. And we can't let it lapse. There's no option of not engaging.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, I'm going to be part of that too, my dear brother. I just was communicating with Brother Adley with his Progressive International, his multiracial, multinational internationalism or extinction, I think is your formulation of it, and rightly so. I want to move just briefly again on the personal thing, the precious people in your life that were formative. It could be your precious parents, Elsie and William. It could be the great Nelson Goodman, my teacher. I think one of the great towering figures in modern philosophy who's underappreciated. I think he's got his form of genius too. But how do you relate to figures in arts, in poetry, in literature? Who are the artists, past and present, who have made a difference in your life as scholar, as intellectual, as activist, as freedom fighter, as lover of justice, truth, and goodness?
There are plenty of them, like people you mentioned, wonderful scholars, great activists. But the people who really made an impression were the ones who our old friend, the late Howard Zinn, called those unknown people, those countless unknown people whose actions set the stage for the events that enter history. Those are the impressive people. And for me, at least, that starts pretty early in my experiences. And some of my earliest memories are riding with my mother in trolley cars in North Philadelphia, going past textile plants where women were on strike outside the plant, being brutally attacked by security officers. That's the kind of memory that sinks in. It was all around. In the later years, it was learning about the struggles of poor and suffering people here and around the world. I've seen many of them, kind of inspiration you can't get from anything else. People who don't give up, who are facing the kinds of torture, repression that we can't even imagine, but don't give up, keep their heads up, keep struggling, win victories. That's the kind of thing that's an inspiration, way beyond anything you can see at the university, in the library, although there's enormous riches there from which you can benefit.
In terms of the particular secular Jewish tradition that you exemplify in such a marvelous way, are there resources that you discern within the Hebrew scripture that Hesed, spreading steadfast love to orphan, widow, fatherless, motherless? Is there something about justice thou should pursue? Is there something about the ways in which your own shaping of your identity, and this is very important these days when everybody's talking about their identity, the shaping of your identity has always led toward this universalism, even though there's still something distinctively Chomskyan, Philadelphian, American, New World, Jewish, all mixed together in making your witness what it is?
It's all in there. I mean, I grew up in a household that was immersed in the revival of Hebrew culture. My father was a great Hebrew scholar. I mean, my earliest lessons in linguistics, which I ended up with, were reading his dissertation on a medieval Hebrew grammarian when I was maybe 10 or 12 years old, learning about historical Semitic grammar and so on. Reading the Bible, I was immersed in that. The later Hebrew literature, you can't read the prophets and not be inspired by the eloquent calls for justice, for mercy, the sharp critiques of the crimes of the powerful, geopolitical critiques, moral critiques. That's one part of the Bible. There are other parts which have a very ugly message, but you pick and choose. Now, that's all in the background. One of the places where I learned about the concept of self-hating Jews, very common today, criticize the state of Israel, you're a self-hating Jew. You listen to Abba Eban, great Israeli statesman, revered statesman, about 40 years ago, gave a lecture to American Jews in one of the main liberal Jewish journals, in which he said, your task is to show that there's no difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, where anti-Zionism meant support for his government in Israel. No difference between those. Well, you read the Bible, you grew up in the Bible, you know exactly where he's coming from. Go back to Kings, remember the epitome of evil in the Bible. King Ahab called the prophet Elijah to him, denounced the prophet Elijah as a Ocher Yisrael, a hater of Israel, because he was condemning the acts of the evil king. And that's the origin. When you remember that, it gives you a different perspective on what's happening today. In fact, when you think of the fate of the prophets, tells you something. They were not treated well. They were imprisoned and driven into the desert. They were ridiculed, persecuted. There were people who were treated well, the flat earthers at the court. Many centuries later, they were condemned as false prophets, not at the time. That tells you something about intellectual history. You go back to the Stax and Widener Library, where I got a lot of my education, learn about intellectual history. You find that that message has been relived over and over again, right to the present. And the people who are calling for mercy, justice, concern for the poor and the suffering, they're the ones who are attacked. We've seen it over and over. And take, say, the Catholic Church, remarkable institution. 1962, Pope John the 23rd called Vatican II and had a message. Let's try to go back to the lesson of the Gospels. The lesson of the Gospels is the preferential option for the poor. It's a message of radical pacifism. Let's go back to that. That actually was taken up by the, mostly in Latin America, some other places, by bishops, priests, lay people who went out to organize peasants, read the Gospels, see what they say, follow the message of taking control of your own lives instead of suffering from the miserable brutality of the murderous governments, most of them installed and backed by the United States. It's called liberation theology. Take a look at the talking points of the School of Americas. It's now renamed, but the School of the Americas, which trains Latin American officers, Latin American killers, to be exact. They have advertising points. One of them is the United States Army helped destroy liberation theology. They're saying something true. 1962, the United States government went to war against the Catholic Church. That's why you have a host of religious martyrs all over Latin America. That's why you have the martyr Archbishop Romero, the six Jesuit intellectuals murdered at the Jesuit University in 1969, right at the time the Berlin Wall fell, by pretty much the same hands, by an elite battalion armed and trained by the United States, following orders which we know were given directly by the Central Command. Okay? Yes, the United States Army helped defeat the Gospels, helped defeat the teachings of the church, okay? That should be front and center in our consciousness, just like the fate of the prophets and the many others like them since then. They're the ones who really suffer, the ones who bring the message of honesty, integrity, support for people who need it, preferential option for the poor, working for the suffering and the needy, changing our societies so that they are directed to people's just rights and needs instead of for maximizing wealth and profit for a tiny sector. Those are the people who are bitterly attacked. They're the ones who, in a famous article, McGeorge Bundy, the national security advisor for Kennedy and Johnson, a former dean of Harvard, wrote a very interesting article in 1968 at the peak of the anti-war movement about how, yes, we've made some foreign affairs, the main establishment journal, worth reading. He said, yeah, we haven't been perfect. We made some mistakes. It's fair to say, talk about our mistakes. But he said there are also wild men in the wings, like all of us, people who say, it's not just a mistake, it's a crime. Wild men in the wings, okay? Mm. You read the prophets, you know where that's coming from. Yes, there's a history, a lot in between. Take a look at the Dreyfus Affair, the time when the modern concept of intellectual came into general use. There were people who we now honor, the Dreyfusards, Emil Zola, people like him. We honor them, not at the time. They were bitterly condemned, denounced. Zola had to flee France. They were condemned by the immortals of the French Academy, the Académie Française. How dare you, the writers and artists, criticize our noble army and our noble state and claim that they committed a crime. Flee the country before we get you. Okay? That's a large part of history. Go back and read. It goes back to classical Greece as well. Who was the person who had to drink the hemlock? The person who was corrupting the youth of Athens by asking too many questions, getting them to think, getting them to question things. We don't want people like that around. We don't want wild men in the wings. That's dangerous to authority and power. And it also carries civilized life forward all over the place. People whose names nobody knows. How many people know the names of the young black kids who 60 years ago sat in a lunch counter at Woolworths in Greensboro North Carolina segregated lunch counter, immediately carried off. Could have ended it, except that others came later. Pretty soon you had freedom riders. You had SNCC workers going out in the South, trying to get terrorized black farmers to dare to vote, suffering, beaten, killed. Anybody know their names? Those are what Howard called the countless unknown people who create the basis for the events in history that make a difference. And they're among us right now.
Mm-hmm. Professor Chomsky, just brilliant and incredibly inspiring, because it's the unknowns and everyday people who we need now more than ever. I know we've taken up a lot of your time here. I understand you're on a schedule and have more. I'm sure everyone wants to hear what you have to say. And in this moment, there's so much crisis. But this has been a great honor and incredibly rich and powerful conversation. And I know I'm just personally very grateful for you to make time to join us on the show. And I know Professor West feels the same.
I just want to express my deep love and respect for my dear brother. I'm telling you, you mean so much to us.
And to know what you're doing, that's keeping the flames burning.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
There
thank you very much, Professor Chomsky, for joining us on the tightrope. You're welcome back anytime, anytime.
Absolutely.
All right, I have to leave you. Enjoyed it.
All right.
Thank you.
Wow.
This episode of The Tightrope is brought to you by Audible. So, Cornell, you actually have one of your audiobooks on Audible. Is that right? Which one is that?
Well, it's my favorite one of all time, which is The Radical King, trying to make available the riches of Martin King and the great Black Freedom Movement. And it was wonderful working with my dear brothers and sisters at Audible. We had a magnificent time.
Wow, that's amazing that such a classic is now accessible by so many people, especially people who might need to be commuting in the car. You know, they can listen to The Radical King. What's your thoughts on that, Cornell?
Well, it's just so important to recognize that Martin believed that nobody really knew him, nobody really understood him, and trying to make sure that we understand that radical dimension, that prophetic dimension, the one that got him in deep trouble, the one that led toward the bullet coming at him on the porch in Memphis. That's what this text was all about, and I'm so glad that Audible makes it available all around the world.
Yes, indeed. Well, I certainly encourage our listeners to check out The Radical King audiobook or otherwise, and many of the other audiobooks on Audible. So if you'd like to give Audible a try and earn a free download, head on over to audible.com/thetightropepod, or you could text the tightrope pod to 500-500. All right, let's get back on the tightrope, Professor.
Sounds good to me. But yeah. It was nice to, you know, Chomsky, he had these wonderful moments that was a tribute to both of us in terms of how he sees us as part of the same tradition he's tried to enact over time. Mm. And it's interesting how he's not really giving ideology a primacy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He wasn't talking about socialism or anarchism or Marxist analysis and so forth. He has a way of just getting right to the core of who's just trying to speak the truth about suffering, whatever mm-hmm. form it is.
Yeah, because ultimately, every one of those political orientations has been on both the right side and the wrong side.
Isn't that the truth? Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
So, you know, you get caught up trying to decide which one of those is right, and you find out that everybody, every group of those has done both.
That's exactly right. Wow. Very much so. But I did notice that when we were pushing his personal stuff on, not just so much family, because he did acknowledge, but the artist, he was very reluctant to talk about.
Yeah, he didn't go there.
Or novelists or musicians, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was interesting how
He didn't offer anybody as even an example. But
he went straight to everyday people, went straight to the heroic one that Howard Zinn talked about.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. But, you know, it is an interesting tension, the existential threat that climate change, and honestly, I don't really pay enough attention to the nuclear threat. That was a very important reframing of the crisis we're in. But, you know, when you think about both of those levels, you wonder if all of this effort to keep us at each other's throats is just to distract us from the fact that everything is being looted while the whole world
Absolutely.
It's a tough thing because you have to say now, what does that mean? We should not be trying to really argue for racial justice movement, say. I mean, if you take this to its logical conclusion, one could make an argument that we're not going to be alive long enough to be worried about racial justice.
We ain't going to be here. Vice president, what color the next vice president is, and the whole planet's about to go under.
But on the other hand, one could say the opposite, which is that, well, the fuel that got us to Trump was the manipulation of race.
That's
to
right.
allow for the looting, right? It was
Absolutely.
The story, right, that brought this mendacity into the White House. So now...
That's exactly right.
You know, so you can't say it's a small potatoes matter, right? It's off on the side. It's not really the real
right.
deal. The real deal is planetary sustenance for the human species. You say, okay, well, how is the human trying to kill itself? Well, it's trying to kill itself through this very story, right? Through this racial project. I don't
know. That's very true. But that's why the indivisibility of these various quests for justice must always be accented
right.
and highlighted. You know what I mean? Because
yeah.
you can see how they're so tied together.
Yeah.
It really,
yeah,
really are.
Right.
Not just on the moral level, but at the analytical level that you just pointed out.
Yeah.
The greed wouldn't be able to run amok if they weren't able to manipulate the racist sensibilities of folk to turn away from what really matters and to be preoccupied with these matters that allow the powerful to be the gangsters that too often they
exactly.
are. I
mean, right. Yeah. And they're promising, you know, to make America great again, you know, while there's not going to be any America left. Not that it was ever great in the first place, but it's not even going to be here. It's a heavy, that was a lot. He put a lot on us there.
He put the whole, especially for our audience. I don't think our audience gets a chance to hear Chomsky at all. He has no access to corporate media for the most part. He's not on CNN, he's not on MSNBC and none of that. And but
right.
now Sister Amy does give him good time.
Yes, Sister Democracy Amy. Now, yeah.
That's true. That's true.
But
our
you know,
audience really to get a chance. And he looks dead up like a Hebrew prophet.
Doesn't he?
As soon as you see his face, you figure like, oh my God, he coming right out of Hebrew scripture. Here he is.
Yeah. And speaking in whole chapters as if it's an oral society, that there's no written word. So he's literally speaking as if it's not written. And he
That's
has
true.
To tell you the whole story.
Well, that was one reason why I was glad to get a little bit into his Jewishness.
Yeah.
Because I know how that's been used against him, but I also know that he never runs from his Jewish strain, even though it's all tied into these other strains. That's why I asked the question
right.
in such a way that I didn't want to.
Yeah, that was beautiful. That was beautiful. And it was clear. I mean, he really respected and understands the roots and origins of his own father's
exactly.
practice. You
that
know,
was
and
interesting
that's
what he said about his father, though.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know his father even wrote a dissertation.
I know. This is the thing. When you really ask people about who they are, and your questions were just perfect, you really learn things that really we should know by now. The brother's 91. Somebody
Isn't
should have
the
asked
truth?
The brother that question.
That's the truth. No,
you know,
I don't
so,
think
I
that,
mean,
many
that was
people
so good.
Know that his father wrote a dissertation on a medieval grammarian.
Right. And he remembers his first linguistic, you know, the beginnings of thinking through the linguistic
thinking
concept.
Through language. And he's 10 and 11 and 12 years old reading the dissertation. This is not an ordinary kind of brother.
No. Well, he hasn't had an ordinary life. And, you know, I mean, his commitment has been remarkable. I'm glad he's landed in a warm climate, minus the rattlesnakes. They are rough out there. But minus that, yeah, they are very serious. But it's nice that he's got space and that he's in a safe environment because he may outlive us all. He might be here.
Oh, you ain't lying.
You know?
he might live just as long as the planet does.
Yeah, he'll be there saying, look, can't say I didn't tell you.
I told y'all and I'm here at the end. I said, Lord, Lord.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us, our tightrope people. We're really thrilled that you join us as often as you do. And we especially want to thank a big shout out to Dwayne and the Real News Network team for their production support. Don't forget to follow us on all kinds of social media, subscribe, and join us the next time on The Tightrope.
Thank you for listening to the Tight Rope podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast and share it with everyone you know. please email all questions, suggestions, and compliments to 411 at speakerbox.com. That's the numbers 411 at speakerbox.com. The Tightrope Podcast is produced by Speakerbox Media in collaboration with the Podcast Laundry Production Company and is executive produced by Dr. Cornell West, Professor Tricia Rose, and Jeremy Berry.